Hello and welcome to End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LaPage.
And Candace, we appreciate you making time in your very busy schedule to join us again on the show.
Sundays in Guelph, I swear to God, it's just like, let's put all the things on the same day.
Absolutely, because there's no other days of the week, man. It's Sunday or nothing. Anyway, End Credits is your local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here in our soon-to-be the end of our temporary home for the summer. That's Thursday at 10 a.m. We talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the horror fantasy drama Death Note. That is in the back half of the show. For the rest half, we're going to talk about some movie news from the past week, including MoviePass. Is it the future of seeing your favorite flicks at the theater or the beginning of the end of the multiplex? Then, from the director of The Hangover and legendary filmmaker Martin Scorsese, a proposed new movie about the origins of the Joker that may or may not have anything to do with Jared Leto. Is there a way this won't possibly suck? But first, we are not a gossip show, but sometimes we have to delve into seemingly gossipy areas. And, you know, we're back there again this week because you know, sometimes these things reveal the greater issues. And this week, there certainly was an example of that. Kay Cole, who you probably won't know by name, but she is the ex-wife of someone who probably will know, Joss Whedon, creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Firefly and director of The Avengers and soon the director of, half-director, shall we say, of Justice League. But, you know, very well-known man, very accomplished man, enjoys a reputation of being something of a feminist. This letter by Kay Cole puts a lot of cold water on that, I think. I will not call myself a feminist. I will not pretend that I see things through the eyes of a woman. But Candace, you are a noted local feminist, and so I'll and a noted Whedon fan. You are a geek girl through and through, so this must have been a pretty hard week for you.
So first let me start by saying her name is pronounced Kai.
Thank you.
Yes, noted feminist, but you're right. I think ahead of noted feminist, it's definitely noted Whedonite. It's kind of my religion in a way. I mean, I think it's fair to say that. I think people, like, there is no measurable way to say how much my life has changed, been impacted, been influenced by the work of Joss Whedon. So, yeah, and I haven't spoken about this really at all because it's kind of a really touchy subject, and I know many of the people that I know very well have been deeply affected by this news from Kai Cole. And it's weird. I don't like being a gossip show either.
I know, there are
certainly issues with just the fact that this news has broke and that it's broken in such an ugly way.
Yeah.
Which is definitely, like, there's a lot of ickiness around that.
Yeah.
So I think what I'm going to say is probably going to shock people. And it's that I never really thought of Joss Whedon as a feminist or as a perfect person. Really.
I'm not sure why that's shocking, but keep going.
Well, a lot of other people, and I think people would think that because I love his work so much, it's like, oh my God, you know, and all this. But it's been really clear to me for a very long time that Joss Whedon is a human who is not perfect and makes a lot of mistakes. And not only that, so what I find interesting is that...
Like Avengers Age of Ultron, I guess.
Yeah, there are definitely some problems with that. But what I find interesting is that long ago when his shows were still on the air, the way he treated his actors, the very hot, like, heavy-handed way he treated them, the way he had absolutely zero tolerance for certain behaviors, to me, that made me go, oh, I get it. This guy is sort of, he is, I don't want to use the term bully.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that he is a bully, but I do think that he's very close to being one. And when you think about bullies in general, they tend to be the people who have had bigger powers bullying them. And so then suddenly when they have some sort of way that they can, you know, exert power over other people, they start doing it. And Joss Whedon has always exerted a lot of power over the people who work for him. Mm-hmm. And that has been really clear for a really long time. And so for me, despite the fact that I do love his work, and I think that in general, the things he had to say were really important and worthy of talking about. I know that him as a person, that he had some problematic things himself. So it's interesting to me that other people seem to, like, none of those things that happened like 10 and 15 years ago were the thing that really upset them.
Mm-hmm.
And that now it's this.
Right.
Which is like, I think the way a person treats their workforce isn't more important than the way they treat their wife.
Right.
But is equally like.
Well, part of it is a workforce issue, right? Because she accused him of, or he confessed to her in a letter that he took advantage of, you know, young actresses who did work on his shows.
Mm-hmm.
The bully aspect too is interesting because, you know, if you think about what happened to Charisma Carpenter during Angel.
Yeah, and she's on my list here of, like, you know, one of the hugest people who was really not treated well by Joss Whedon.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, there's probably an essay full of stuff that can be just written about that alone. And, you know, it happened when she got pregnant, and then the pregnancy was written into the show, and then she was kind of quietly written off the show right after that. Angel, Buffy spinoff is what we're talking about. And yeah, that's considering her long-term involvement in that series and that franchise, it's, you know, particularly... You know, it's particularly bad when you kind of go into the behind the scenes stuff of what happened there. And on top of it all, there's just the sort of ickiness of, you know, another male authority who, you know, exerts both his maleness and his authority over, you know, the women that work for him. And also his fans. I think there was some level of allegation I was with female fans as well, which is also very icky.
It is icky. And I don't say this excuse him of the actions, because he is ultimately the one who is able to decide whether or not to actually take part in someone throwing themselves at him.
Right.
But I do also know that that happens, right? There's so much about any sort of entertainment industry where people want to be there. They want to be close. They develop crushes, or whatever you want to call infatuations, and will do anything to be there. And so I'm never surprised when I hear about on-set romances. I'm never, ever surprised. I understand the
living the dream, right?
Well, not only that too, but just the, like, you're spending like 18 hours a day with these people. You're creating these sort of experiences that absolutely nobody is a part of. And so when you walk away from that, it's just like, but you don't understand this thing that happened here. And the only person who does understand it are the other people who were there with you.
Right.
And it's just this really exhilarating, very strong bond that's hard to understand.
Right.
So these things happen really regularly. And I think with Joss Whedon, it probably happened once.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe happened a second time. And then he started to feel really bad about himself, because he's like, wow, look at me. I'm doing all the things that I think are wrong.
Right.
And unfortunately, then that just breeds more self-loathing and more taking part in the addicting behavior.
Right.
And it's so ironic, because one of those things, those zero tolerance things that he has, is around other people's addictions.
Right. And that's a great point, because I was sort of two minds of this. It's like, first of all, it's like, it's about a personal relationship between Whedon and his wife. And then the second part of it is the greater culture, and the fact that he's been cast in the light as sort of, you know, the Hollywood feminist. And then I listened to Liana Kay, who's Ed the Sock's business partner and real life partner. The guy who plays Ed the Sock, whose name I can't remember.
Steve.
She's not married to a sock. It's I just want to make that distinction. But she did a sort of podcast rant about it, and it galvanized a lot of thoughts for me. And she her point was basically, I hope I'm not butchering it, is that, you know, if you're a horn dog, you know, kind of be a horn dog. Sex isn't dirty. Sex isn't bad.
Yeah.
But her problem was the way the letter that Kai Cole quoted was that, you know, he felt like he was, like, possessed, that he had, like, a monster, that he was part of this Greek myth, something like out of a Greek myth is, I think, an exact term he used. So, you know, one of her problems was that he was sort of putting this off onto an outside force that was, you know, sort of compelling him to do this. And, you know, her point was, like, if you're going to be a horn dog, at least own up to being a horn dog.
Yeah.
And I think that's was fairly insightful for me. This isn't nothing. Mm-hmm. And I did read an editorial on the Spike TV site for some reason. But it's like, you know, they're trying to cast it as part of the outrage culture. And I don't think it was part of the outrage culture. I mean, the reaction to it. They meant the reaction to it. But, I think it's just there is something about it where it smells like he's trying to have it both ways.
Yeah.
I can be a horn dog, but it's not my fault. It's, you know.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, we can talk about, so he often writes himself into many characters.
Right.
And I think most people are going to think that in Firefly, he was writing himself into Wash. Mm. And I don't think so. I think he had progressed beyond that goofball Xander Wash character.
Right.
And was actually writing himself into Malcolm Reynolds. And Malcolm Reynolds,
who's a swashbuckling captain in the tight pants.
Yeah, but he was the person who had the most problem with Inara, the character who was a legal prostitute, because in this world, prostitution was legal. He just couldn't deal with the fact that there was a woman who was completely in control of her own body, her own person, her own sexuality, and used that for her own purposes.
While he was in love with her.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty astute reading. It's interesting, and I wish we could talk more about it, but...
Yeah, I can. I may, perhaps. I don't know. And now that we've opened the floodgates, I might record a whole lot more thoughts about this. And...
Yeah, I mean, it's something that might not go away either, because, you know, there was also a thing about Louis C.K. this week, someone else who has, like, a huge cult following, I think it was a woman who was a writer for his show, or she was involved in the production of his show in some way, talking about how he was basically bullying her. So it's, you know, we got to kind of watch it with some of this hero worship, because, you know, sometimes our heroes are deeply flawed human beings.
All the time. Not sometimes, all the time. We are all human.
Right.
No one is perfect. People are going to make mistakes. So we can't put people on pedestals.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other end to some of the mistakes people make, we need to give them a little bit of leeway on it. I mean, I don't know much about this Louis C.K. thing.
No,
but,
I don't know much about it either.
You know, in some ways you have to, like, one person does one thing or a couple of things that don't quite go along with what they've been saying.
Right.
And yes, that makes them a liar or a hypocrite or whatever. The best people, the ones who should be our heroes, are the ones who go, oh, this is really bad. I need to fix this somehow.
Right.
And sometimes that means I have to tell my wife that I've been doing this for 15 years. Mm-hmm. May or may not have been the right decision for him to do that. But, you know, the people who realize I'm not living the life I want to live because I'm doing these things wrong. How do I fix this?
Yeah, I think that's a incredibly important point, because we have seen a lot of people do maybe stupid things in the media lately, and then they're quickly you know, put in a bag and
thrown out of the bus. Yeah.
And I don't think that helps anyone.
Nope.
Especially the person who made the mistake, because it doesn't give them a chance to make up for it or address it in some way. And the immediate reaction is defend, because otherwise you might be out the door and under the bus pretty quickly. Speaking of under the bus, AMC, the movie theater chain, is...
Yeah.
Ugh, these segues aren't always going to be 10 stars, people. The AMC movie chain, I think it's still around in Canada. I know the biggest one in downtown Toronto has since become a Cineplex, but I think it's still around in places.
Yeah, I think it's a few. Yeah.
But this doesn't affect Canada. There's a program in the United States called Movie Pass, where you pay now $10 a month, $9.95, and you get access to movie theater. Basically, you flash your card, and you get a ticket, and you can go into the movie theater. Mm-hmm. AMC is one of the early, shall we say, unadopters of trying to get out of this. They feel like that the cheapness, they sound like they're trying to make the business case and not necessarily the we hate technology case, but they're trying to make the business case that $10 a month, it's not going to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. And then the movie pass is going to fall apart, or it's going to close up shop, and then people are going to be blaming the movie theater for having too many expensive tickets. But you know what? I think the cynical part of my brain is like, you know what? We see this with adaption and new technologies and new programs and things. We saw it with VCRs. Mm-hmm. We saw it with DVD. We saw it with streaming. We saw it with piracy. And now I think MoviePass, it's not going to go away because AMC doesn't think it's sustainable.
Yeah. Well, and so I have two different thoughts here. One is about the fact, like, I understand that they're concerned, you know, and I was reading a number of things and people are like, I don't, like, how are they going to make money, right? Yeah. If you're only paying $10 a thing. So I think first, they were doing this for a while at a different price. Mm-hmm. And clearly they were getting enough people buying it to think, okay, let's lower the price to get more people in. And just because they've lowered it to $10 now doesn't mean a year from now they're not going to up it to $15 or something. And a little bit, you know, making it a little bit more reasonable. But the main thing is that this really just proves to me that Americans have no understanding of how socialized business works. Here's the deal. Adam buys a movie pass for $10, never goes.
Yeah.
So you pay $10 a month, you're paying $120 a year. I buy one for $10. They're also making $120 a year from me. And I go to see two movies a month.
Right.
Well, they're still, you're paying for my movies.
Right.
This is the way it goes. If you get 300,000 people all spending $120 a year and only, because the reality is not everybody's going to go to see a movie every single 24-hour option. Like, really, they're really not. They might go see a movie every week, but even then, it's still probably not going to happen. Maybe twice a month. Maybe there'll be a couple of months where it's like, oh, I went like four times this month.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, it's still a deal. Like, I buy a $10 thing, even if I bought it like $15, it's still a deal, right? This is why they can't get socialized medicine. They can't understand how other people subsidize other people.
Well, I mean, we've seen a lot of American politicians basically not understand how insurance works. It's like, you have well people paying for sick people. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, but the sick people are also paying for the well people. It's amazing, because when the well person needs it, the sick person has been putting in all the money, too.
That's right, too. I did note the MoviePass noted like a 7-time increase in the last month in terms of the number. And I'm wondering how much of that is just hype and how much of it is just like the solid sort of round number of $10 a month, because that's like Netflix price. It's like, oh, I can pay a Netflix price and then go see a movie every week or every day.
Yeah.
Bargain. And then, you know, best laid plans. Nobody's seeing a movie every day unless you're a critic or something.
Yeah. Well, they don't even, like, well, I guess maybe if 5 movies come out a week, then sure, there's one movie to see every single day. But I feel like there's probably not even enough movies coming out for someone to go see a movie every single day. Mm. And you wouldn't you think the theater would want people to come? Like, I've been to see the movies a lot lately since I've joined this program.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I'm there, it's me and 4 other people. It doesn't matter if it's cheap night, if it's Friday at 9 p.m., if it's Sunday afternoon. It doesn't matter. There's nobody in the theater.
Mm.
So wouldn't the theater want more people to be coming so that they can sell them their 400% marked up snacks?
Well, that's the thing too, is that that's where the theater makes the money. At least that's what is always being said, is that it's, you know, the popcorn. Now if you go up to the Galaxy Cinema, actually either of the Galaxy Cinemas in town, they have like a little counter there where there's like knickknacks and stuff.
Oh, and, yeah, like, you can buy toys.
Pencil heads and toys. Mm-hmm. And and all this other thing. So, and then there's arcades in both those theaters. So, you know, they're finding ways to make money. Mm-hmm. It may not be great money given where the culture is, but that, you know, the movie ticket price isn't where they're making the money.
Yeah. Yeah. I would think that a theater should be all on board any way to get more people to the theater. I do understand, however, this is a startup and, you know, essentially AMC is taking an IOU every time they take one of those credit things.
Right.
And it's entirely possible that, much like many other startups that have gone, you know, 2, 3, 4 years getting a lot of seed money and being able to sort of make things work, and then there's no more money coming in and it's like, okay, great, now I can't pay anybody anything.
Well, look at something like Netflix, which most people would consider a success. Mm-hmm. But it's, I think it was reported there's something like $20 billion in debt.
Yeah.
And when you kind of start putting Bs on the amount of money you're in debt, you start mm-hmm. thinking like, well, this business isn't going to last, but this is Netflix.
Yeah.
And because they kind of keep the, you know, their numbers in terms of the number of streams and downloads of the various things in a black box. Nobody knows how successful something like Death Note is mm-hmm. or The Defenders or Stranger Things or anything like that. You know, and because a lot of people are talking about these things on social media, so yeah. there's definitely perception that they are incredibly successful, even though mm-hmm. they are deeply, deeply in the red. And, you know, that the same might be said of MoviePass in a couple of years, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to go away, because if enough people are using it, mm-hmm. Or enough people are talking about it, like, yeah, I just went and saw, you know, Thor Ragnarok with my MoviePass, or, you know, it's an incredibly weird era in business. It's not cut and dry blue chip, you know, who's up in the stock exchange. There are several different measurements in terms of what makes you a success mm-hmm. now.
Well, no, it's even back then, though, mm. right? Cash flow is very different than assets and liabilities.
Yes.
Right? And if the cash keeps flowing, businesses can continue operating no matter how
right.
deep their debt is. But, you know, like, it's when the cash flow stops that it becomes a problem.
Yeah.
And so right now, MoviePass is making an immense amount of cash flow.
Yeah. I'll be very interested to see sort of where this is in a year, whether it's like, you know, like you're saying, is that if they decide to jack up the price again, mm-hmm. they sort of meet like a minimum number of new subscribers that they were looking for. And then whether or not they meet those targets. And I haven't managed to find out what their targets were. They're just mm-hmm. like, it's up, it's up, it's up. And it's like, yes, it's $10. People are talking about it. It's a new thing. So, yeah, I would not sound the death knell of the theater experience mm-hmm. just yet. But I mean, I we're getting closer, because on the flip side, they're also talking about shortening the release window between VOD and theatrical release, and, you know, things like the screening room where you pay $60 a month and you mm-hmm. can get access to things as they come yeah. out that weekend. So,
well, and you know what? I mean, this, I'm just going to throw in an extra little topic here, but
sure, why not?
But here's the reality, right? I love this idea of shortening the release, because the thing is, like, there are films playing right now that I'm sure there's almost nobody going to see them.
Mm.
What they could be doing is re-releasing past stuff, right? I went to go see Terminator 2 last night.
Oh, awesome.
Right? I'm going to go spend $10 to go see Terminator 2. I'm looking at the list of things at the theater. I'm like, there's nothing to go see. Like, this is the dry zone. What am I going to go see? Oh, Terminator 2 just was yeah. re-released. I'm going to go spend money to see that.
Yeah.
So you don't have to constantly have new releases. There are things that you can play
mm-hmm.
that will get people there.
And Guelph Movie Club at the Bookshelf, that's like a really successful yeah. monthly thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, 1 month it's Ghostbusters and 1 month it's Batman 89. And I think they're doing Faster Pussycat Kill Kill this
yes.
week. So, you know, there are opportunities that way. We do want to get in one last of our pre-planned topics. This one is so silly, and I'm surprised it's attracted talent like this. But, it, you know, they've announced a Joker origin movie, or at least they're developing a Joker origin movie. Hangover writer-director Todd Phillips is co-writing the script with 8 Mile writer Scott Silver. Martin Scorsese's going to produce?
Yeah, I mean, we're a little long on time, so let me just sum this up with no.
It's crazy, because they have so many Batman projects in development. They have the Batman, which is being directed by Matt Reeves of the Planet of the Apes films. Mm-hmm. They've talked about a Joker and Harley Quinn movie. They talked about Gotham City Sirens, which is all the sort of female villains mm-hmm. teaming up in one movie. They've talked about Nightwing. They've talked about Batgirl. They've talked about more Suicide Squad. Like, half of the Suicide Squad was Batman villains. And it's, you know, on top of all that, we, you know, speaking of learning lessons, I made a list of sort of like prequel horror movies that try to explain the villain origin. There's like Alien Covenant this past summer, uh-huh. Hannibal Rising, Annabelle. Well, Annabelle Creation, from what I've understood, is
I've understood that as well. But the first Annabelle was not good.
No, it was not good. Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Beginning.
Rob Thomas's Halloween. Like, who needed
Zombie?
Yes, thank you.
The Matchbox 20 guy did not.
Interesting to. Could be the Veronica Mars.
Or it could be the Veronica Mars Rob Thomas too. That I would watch, actually. And then there's another Texas Chainsaw Massacre prequel coming out on VOD next month, Leatherface. And it's just like, nope. You know, but the thing with these villains, and the thing with Joker too, is that, you know, it's a force of nature kind of thing. It's, you know, you don't know where they're from. You don't know what they want. You know, and Michael Caine has the great speech in The Dark Knight about, you know, some people just want to watch the world burn. And I mean, that's as much of an origin I think you need. And then, you know, they're trying to do this in the comic books all the time, too. They're trying to explain, like, oh, the Joker does this because this. And then I think there's a storyline in the Batman comics right now where there's, like, Batman's discovered that the Joker's, like, three different Jokers.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's not confusing.
Yeah. See, that face you made is the exact reason why this is stupid.
Yeah. And, but I mean, it is very strange, the list of people attached to this, though.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't find three further from each other groups of people, right? The Hangover and 8 Mile and Scorsese. What?
Yeah.
What? I don't, this is, it's just really strange.
Well, it is. I mean, and keep in mind that this is probably something in like very early stages, and
so none of those people are going to finish.
Well, you never know, right? You never know, because one of the things I think in terms of modern sort of movie reporting is that we know things that we wouldn't have known mm-hmm. 30, 40 years ago when we're talking about the development of movies. Now, if it's like, if someone has a great idea and Warner Brothers is like, yes, that's perfect, draft the press release, and then away it goes. And I think, you know, 40 years ago, like back in the 70s, you know, you wouldn't know about this until you saw the trailer in the theater. And so, you know, in 5 years, I think we're going to be all going to be asking, hey, whatever happened to that Joker movie? But
yeah, I just really think the Joker does not work in live action movie or television.
Really?
He just doesn't. I mean, live action has a certain amount of realism to it, no matter how wacky it is. Like, Gotham, I think, does a really good job of being really bananas with their show. But even still, they haven't introduced Joker, but they've kind of flirted with it.
They flirted with Joker, I
think the Joker will not work in that. He is just too over the top. He works in cartoon. He works in graphic novel. I just don't believe that he will ever work in live action.
Even Ledger?
Could not finish that movie.
Interesting.
I tried to watch it so many times, and I have never been able to finish it. I keep falling asleep.
We're going to have to do a show about that someday.
Yeah.
In the meantime, we're going to take a musical break before we do our review, which is of Death Note, which is on Netflix. And to get you in the mood, here's Death of a Bachelor from the album Death of a Bachelor. And the band is Panic at the Disco. And the show is End Credits. You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Now we could, in this dream of yours, take care of a situation like this. We just put Kenny's name down and see what happens. I know you want to. Go on. Help her.
I don't have a pen. It's a good thing that you have a pen.
And that was a scene from Death Note. It is the new film from Adam Wingard. It stars Nat Wolff, Lakeith Stanfield, Margaret Qualley, Shai Wingham, and Willem Dafoe, the great voice and facial expressions of Willem Dafoe. And it's based on a manga, which is Japanese comic book, if you're not familiar with the nomenclature, which neither of us have read.
Nope.
Even though I think, well, there are Japanese people in it. There is
one Japanese person in it, yes.
And there's a scene that I think that takes place in Tokyo, in quote marks.
Yeah.
I think it still holds the quality of what you get out of. I read the sort of the wiki page of the manga, and it seems to hold on to a lot of the details of it and the Japanese feel of it pretty good.
Yeah, it's all right. I mean, primarily, not that how do you say his name? Lakeith Stanfield did an amazing job as
He's
L,
great. Yeah.
Like such a good job, and I would never want to take the part away from him. But that one especially, I was like, that I feel like this should have been played by a Japanese person, like because that he's the you know, when I think of Death Note, which is funny because I didn't really know very much about it, but I've seen, you know, images and things like that, and I realized, I was like, oh, that character is the character that you always see with Death Note because he's always in that
Ryuk.
That No, because he's in the he sits.
Oh, you mean Al?
Yeah, right. He sits in the like pigeon position, sort of.
Yeah.
Right, and that's with the hood up.
Bazooka Joe.
Okay, really, Bazooka Joe, really? But like, anytime I've seen something Death Note related, it's always had L, the detective, as the image that goes with it.
Yeah.
So, and I just sort of assumed, we said, you know, I've never read it, so I had no idea who anybody was. So I kind of assumed that he was either the person, because I knew that it was a person and he had something and he wrote people's names. Like, I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
Something about writing people's names and they die or whatever. I figured he was the person who was doing that just because of all of the...
Yeah.
And it's not. He's the detective.
That's like the most sort of manga part of it, I think, is this character and the whole idea of, like, he's part of this detective cult or detective society.
Yeah, I'm assuming there's like a whole, like this is a whole other story that weaves through a variety of different manga novels.
Yeah, that, it's a huge part of the original manga series. Again, just from my cursory Wikipedia reading of the manga, there's a whole organization of elves and it's kind of the arch enemy of the character Light, his English name is Light in this movie, gets this book, the Death Note. You write somebody's name in it, and you can write in details of how they die, and then voila, it happens. And so he begins sort of this movement called Kira, which sort of is, you know, a vigilante. He uses the book in a vigilante capacity where he hears about a bad person, writes down. You have to know the person's face and know their name. You write down both as you write. You remember the person's face as you write down their name and how they die, and voila. And so that's kind of the archenemy, the L detective agency or whatever it is, and the detective L. I like the whole idea, but Adam Wingard does a pretty good job of sort of boiling all that down into, you know, an hour and 40 minutes, but. It's very much like checklist sort of screenwriting. We need to get this done. He needs to find the book. He needs to find out how to use the book. He needs to show the girl how the book works and get her involved. And they start this Kira thing. And now we're moving on to L and the detective stuff. And it moves very, very quickly without kind of stopping to marinate on any one thing. And it would have been interesting if he finds the book and it becomes about the whole Kira phenomenon, mm-hmm. or he finds the book and he decides to start punishing people in his neighborhood, or, you know, as he kind of does in the beginning. The first, yep. that clip there, it's the first time he uses it, and it's against the bully, mm-hmm. the school bully. Pretty grisly death scene too.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. Like, I do think this could have used a lot more space.
Yeah.
It was really, like, there was a lot in there. They did a good job. I don't feel like, I feel like there's a lot more to explore in this yeah. world, and there could have been a lot more storytelling around certain things, but I don't feel like I didn't understand what was going on. Like,
yeah.
they did a really good job of really making sure that you had everything you needed to enjoy it and find the conclusion satisfying.
Yeah, it's they do a pretty good job of presenting the rules and kind of sticking to the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of key in a horror concept like this. And he even asks questions. And, you know, in the beginning, when he first gets a hold of the book, and he asks the Ryuk, the demon,
mm-hmm.
or Ryuk.
Ryuk.
Ryuk, the demon, yeah. who's sort of the keeper of the book, is like, well, if I wrote your name in it, could I kill you? You know, that was just something you would, I think you would
yeah.
ask, because you probably want to look for some of these loopholes. But yeah, mm-hmm. I think there was a philosophical element that was teased at too,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, well, you know, if you could see somebody on the news who's arrested for taking hostages or murder or something, but what if they're innocent? Or what if they had a, you know, like the Jean Valjean thing, like
yeah.
stealing bread
well,
for
and
your
just
family.
To get really SJW about this. Doesn't everybody, and we sort of already brought it up in the first half, right? Doesn't everybody get an opportunity to fix their mistake,
right.
to learn from their mistake? Yes, I broke the law. Yes, I did something, and I feel remorse for that, and now I'm making reparations so that I can become a better person. Doesn't everybody get that opportunity?
Yeah, penance.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like the movie kind of goes hard against, like, truly, you know, mean, disgusting people, because mm-hmm. one of the people he goes after initially is the man who killed his mom, and it's kind
yeah.
of implied that he's like this mob person, so he's
mm-hmm.
you know, slick.
Yeah, it's not
slick
like it
Rick
was an
and,
accident per se.
Yeah, and I do like the death scenes, and the death scenes have like a very Final Destination kind of feel.
Yeah,
in it.
This whole thing felt like like the next Final Destination.
Yeah.
I believe that would be Final Destination 6, maybe?
I think you might be right.
Because I think maybe I might own all of them.
Well, I remember the last Final Destination ended in a loop. It ended with the beginning of the first Final Destination.
That's right, because it was a prequel, a hidden. You didn't know that
yeah,
it was.
You find out in the end
right.
it's a prequel. That's
I
right.
totally forgot that.
Spoiler
that
alert
was really
for
good.
Final Destination 5.
Yeah, so I did sort of feel like, you know, I enjoyed this film. I think it did what it was trying to do. And I did feel, you know, to bring up that Final Destination thing, I did sort of feel like, oh, this could be the next straight-to-video Final Destination film,
mm-hmm.
as many of them were. And it was interesting, because then I was like, well, what is it about this production that makes me feel like, oh, it's a straight-to-video sort of production?
Mm.
And I've never quite been able to put my finger on what it is that you know, whether it's the coloring or the editing. And what I thought it was the music.
Because
I was like, yeah, actually this sort of sounds like temp tracks. I think that's what it is. Everything sounded like temp tracks. So didn't it blow my mind at the end when I was reading because I read the credits, and there it is, Atticus Ross, Oscar winner Atticus Ross, did the music for this film.
Yeah, it's, I think Trent Reznor maybe did the heavy lifting in that partnership.
He might have. Oh, he must? I don't know. Sorry, Atticus
no.
Ross. Okay, your music's great. The theme
Atticus
was
Ross
very
is throwing
good.
His iPod at the wall right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, the theme to Death Note
yeah.
was great.
Yeah.
But I really felt like all the music throughout everything else, I was like, this could be...
There was some weird music, especially in the last sort of deaths where it's
I
like...
I did love
power.
The double beater Cetera, though.
Yeah.
That actually was, I loved it, because it started with a Chicago song
yeah.
during the big sort of, you know, climax, and then it ended with a remake of The Power of Love.
Yeah, the Air Supply version.
Air Supply, I know, right? I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, music was sort of a big thing for me. You know, in a horror movie, I think the music adds to the atmospherics, because
mm-hmm.
this thing is really well shot, I thought, really
yeah.
well edited. It, you know, it should, the money is on the screen. I love the cast in this movie. You know, we talked about Lakeith. But
he
like
was great.
Nat Wolff was like perfectly bland as Light. Shea Whingham as his dad. He did a really good job with some of the cornball stuff with that character. It was like, you know, my name is my reputation. At one point, he says when Light's talking to him about like, why aren't you going after the guy that murdered our mom? You're a cop. You're like, why can't cops just like do stuff? And he's like, well, my name's my reputation. I have to like follow the law. And he does a really good job with that. And Margaret Qualley as Maya, as Light's girlfriend, she was so good.
She was really good. She did such a like. I was like, I can't decide ever if she really loves him or if it's all just an act. She was so totally walking that line.
There's a weird thing about it where about her character in particular, the mix of like murder and sex, and like they're in his room and they're adding names to the book, and she's like, okay, great, and then off comes the top ready to make out. She's like so magnetic to watch, and she was in The Nice Guys too. She was one of the lesser characters in The Nice Guys, although pretty important character. But there is a magnetic quality to her. I found just from these two movies, watching her in The Nice Guys and watching her here, she's so great in this. And you're right, you don't know if it's like she is really in love with him. Or if she's in love with that, you know, they're doing all this murderous stuff.
Good.
And nobody
they're doing
knows.
Good.
Yeah, they're doing good. And that's kind of a turn on or what it is. And
yeah, because we get zero backstory on her. Like, she's got no parents, no friends, no like.
It's so weird because the first time we see her is she's the typical kind of like anti-establishment cheerleader where she's on the cheer squad, but she's the only one with dark hair, and she's there doing the pyramid smoking cigarette.
Yeah.
And so she's a complete mystery. So it's you know, she kind of comes into his life at the same time the Death Note does.
Yeah.
So it you know, there's kind of a weird duality between Ryuk, who we haven't talked about yet, and then you know the fact that she's there too, a kind of yin yang, you know, she might
I mean, the dark and the light, right? I feel like her and Light are sort of the yin yang.
Well, not only that, but I think Ryuk is the demon is you know, it's kind of straight up with the intentions of it, and then but she's the one who's kind of got questionable intentions about why she's wants to do this and why she's with Light. And and casting Willem Dafoe as Ryuk, it's like the most genius, most straightforward casting you can imagine. And I love how they didn't make him sort of I don't know, they didn't put the spotlight on him. Most of the times when you see him, he's kind of lurking in the background.
Yeah, he was always not in focus. Like, they did such a great job with the monster design. And then, I don't remember the guy's name, but someone else does the actual, is in the costume.
Yeah.
So does all the sort of body movement. And clearly that person is really very, very good at what he does. Because he always just was lurking and standing and very menacing.
Yeah.
But he was always just in the background, which was great. I'm like, we don't ever really need to see him. Like, we can see the outline and then his red eyes.
Yeah.
And then Willem Dafoe does all the work with the talking.
Yeah, and it's such a great such a great blend of sort of character and actor, because he's, you know, he can do such creepy things, you know, without a mask. I think it was like really kind of the simplest casting call you could make on something like this, is to get someone like Willem Dafoe to play the death monster or death god or whatever he was supposed to be. That's never quite explained, but I don't think it needed. I think there was just the right amount of Ryuk in this.
Yeah, well, and I love that it wasn't really explained either, because, you know, we don't really know to get into sort of more the supernatural sort of thing, right? Yeah. Like, why do these demons exist? Is this actually to maintain balance, or is it to sow chaos? Mm-hmm. Because when he first arrives, he's very clear, like, if you don't think you can do this, fine. Like, you know, well, and he just kept sort of telling Light, like, I don't think this is for you.
Yeah.
Like, you should just leave it.
Yeah.
And I'll go find the next person.
Mm-hmm.
But then once Mia comes into his life and things start changing, then he's all like, great, now I'm going to play with you. Right? And it's like, well, why would a demon or a god or whatever, you know, bother playing with someone? Like, it's, what is his purpose?
Yeah, it's a very kind of trickster god thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you don't want to do this. You don't want to do this. You don't want to do this. And then, of course, when somebody says that, you want to do it all the more. And then at the end, he lights in the hospital. He says to him, humans are so interesting. So you kind of knew, it's kind of inferred that he was sort of pushing him by not pushing him. And so he likes to play the game. And it's you know, whether this was kind of, again, was it part of the plan? Or is he doing this because humans are so easy and fun to screw with? That's a question I think that's left in the end.
Yeah. I would love to find out more about these detectives, though, right? So, because this is a thing that was sort of, you know, I think they did a good enough job of introducing it and explaining it. But I think, yes, like that is one of those places where they could really have done a whole other, like that could be its own television series, right?
Because for sure.
L comes from this, I don't remember what the name of it was, but, you know, an orphanage where people go into a training program to become the world's best detectives.
Yeah.
And, you know, they do all this, like, the feeding schedule and the, like, sleeping schedule, all this stuff.
Yeah.
To make the mind so much sharper.
That was an interesting, his assistant is always, I'm surprised this never came back into it, but, you know, his assistant is always saying to him, like, sleep is the key to a, you know, a stronger mind. And he's like, no, I'm not going to sleep right now. And and then he's like mainlining candy all the time.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there's so many weird touches with this. And then on top of it, there, you know, the training orphanage place is in Montauk, which is, of course, the source of many conspiracy theories involving, you know, anything from death rays to UFOs and, you know, MK Ultra and that kind of thing. So it's, you know, there's so many layers to peel back on that. It's, I almost wish that, and of course they have been talking about sequels. So if they had made like movie one all about Kira and then brought an L for movie two, that would have been interesting. But I mean, I think there's a lot of room left to explore. I like the, you know, as I said, I like the cast. I like the look. I think, you know, the movie, as I said, it was very sort of a checklist sort of screenplay in terms of going through the motions. But, you know, having done the first one, I wouldn't mind seeing the second.
No, I mean, I would definitely watch more. And I was interested the whole time. Yeah. Like, it was, you know, an hour and whatever it was, an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and 30 minutes, well spent. Like, I do not regret having watched it. And there's certainly, I mean, I'm a pretty big fan of B-movies, and this was absolutely not that. Like, this was definitely a good quality.
Yeah, it was very good quality. I do kind of, I mean, to go back to what you said earlier about, you know, was it being on TV that, you know, made you think of sort of like a direct-to-video sort of cheapness of it. This is kind of like the first time I've really sat down to watch a Netflix movie, a movie that was released on Netflix. At least that wasn't a documentary. I watched a lot of documentaries on Netflix. But to sort of sit down and watch a movie made for Netflix was kind of, it had a very direct, in terms of how your brain processed it, it had a very direct to video sort of viewing experience. So you're watching it through the lens of seeing something on video for the first time.
Yeah.
And I wonder how this would feel in the cinema too. And it's kind of hard to find a Netflix. Netflix will release movies that they are releasing in limited release in theaters. But I would be interested in seeing this, how it would compare seeing this in the theater versus seeing it on Netflix in your living room.
Whether it's just an actual psychological thing where you know you're just, you know, it's Saturday afternoon and I'm just sitting in my living room watching this film.
Yeah, and that's it. And I watched this as part of sort of, I did a bit of an Adam Wingard Film Festival too, because I rewatched Your Next and The Guest and Blair Witch as well after. I watched Death Note first because I was kind of interested because I found Adam Wingard before Blair Witch came out last year when I watched his first two movies, Your Next, which is an awesome horror movie, and The Guest, which is, it's not really a horror movie, but it's kind of like in the mold of The Hitcher and those kind of movies.
Okay.
But Blair Witch sort of defecated the bed, let's say, because it was it was like very much how you would expect a Blair Witch movie to be remade in 2016, 2017.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
So this gets back to more of the Adam Wingard I want to see. and, you know, kind of more character driven. And I think this shows off what he can do much better than what Blair Witch, because I think these are the two movies people will find Adam Wingard as Blair Witch, mm-hmm. and Death Note. And if you have to see the one, definitely see Death Note.
Yeah.
And then find your, I think Your Next and The Guest are both on Netflix as well. So yeah, this guy's a definite talent, but I think that'll be put to the test again, because his next movie is Godzilla versus King Kong.
That's a big step up. Yeah. Maybe he won't really show either of the monsters. That would be kind of cool.
Well, Godzilla did that in the Gareth Edwards Godzilla, yeah, and people got mad.
People. Who invited them anyways?
I think... I think he's a great talent, and definitely Your Next, which is like, if you liked what was that movie about the people with bags over their heads killing Scott Speedman and Liv Tyler?
The Strangers.
Strangers, yes. Yeah. It's very Strangers in that mold.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if I've seen Your Next or not. I feel like I might have, but it's just not, it hasn't stuck out for me for some reason.
But that was really well made, and I would highly recommend it, and The Guest as well.
Mm-hmm.
Getting back to Death Note, William B. Davis cameo.
How did I miss that?
I don't know. It's in like with the Kira montage.
Yeah.
And he plays like this Alex Jones kind of radio shock jock.
What?
And,
really? Oh yeah. My god! I'm definitely gonna have to watch that again.
And he's like, "This is a false flag," and it's kind of funny watching William Cancer Man pretending to be.
Yeah.
Alex
well,
Jones.
I did hear. I remember hearing about how it's the largest false flag, you know, thing in the history of America.
That was
William
B.
Davis. Because I
laughed
about that. Oh my gosh! I'll have to pay more attention.
Yeah, it's great. That's another thing. It was shot in Vancouver, but they didn't use a lot of Vancouver. Like,
no, it did not look like
Vancouver.
Like, I was surprised at the end when I saw that it was shot in Vancouver. I was like, really? I did. Yeah. I wouldn't have pegged that as a Vancouver.
Yeah. Well, it that wouldn't have surprised me if I hadn't known it was in Vancouver, because William B. Davis, of course, Vancouver-based actor, and then the principal of the school was Paul McGowan. No, not McGowan. The guy who played the doctor in Stargate Atlantis. The Scottish guy.
Oh, yeah. That's why I recognized him.
Yeah. So, I mean, there were only a couple of Vancouver, Vancouver in quote mark actors. Because anytime something's shot in Vancouver, you kind of recognize
them. Yes, the Vancouver Day Players.
The Vancouver Day Players, that's right.
That's what I call them.
But, yeah, so it really surprised me. I kind of went into this thinking it's like, I don't know, because it's a manga movie made by Americans, something that's not very successful.
No.
See Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
It's, you know, Adam Wingard coming off of Blair Witch again, you know, sort of this sort of terrible Hollywood hogwash kind of thing. And then, you know, it's kind of on Netflix, which has not had a great track record with its movies so far. But, yeah, just to reiterate, worth checking out, worth watching. You know, wait till after dark. I think that might.
Yeah.
not on the sunny afternoon. And yeah, the cast is great. And
yeah, again,
Adam Wingard is a talent.
Lakeith Stanfield, like,
awesome.
Really, you know, and most people probably have just seen him in Get Out, where he was also really
short. Yeah, he's a short scene in Get Out, and you probably saw it in the trailers, but in like one scene, he is. He was so awesome.
Yes, I mean, it was exhilarating to watch him on screen. So seeing him in this, I was really pleased. I was like, "Ooh, this is exciting! I'm going to see, you know, what else he can do." And it was really great because
he
was really kind of all over the place in his character. Like it was, we got to see a lot of different facets of the character L. So
yeah, they could spin off that character so easy. And he was Snoop in Straight Outta Compton.
I haven't seen Straight Out of Compton. I can't believe I haven't. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I didn't get a chance to see it yet.
But yeah, so keep that's something to keep your eye on.
Snoop, really?
He was Snoop, yeah.
I would have pegged him as a different character. Intriguing. Okay.
Well, you never know. You never know who will turn up as what, when. And we'll leave that there. Because that's the end of our show this week. End credits. We hope you liked it. If you do like it, you can find it again on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on the Facebook, End Credits Radio on Twitter. Candace, where can people find you on the internet?
I am most easily found using the handle Cinn48, C-I-N-N-4-8, and you can find out about all of the many, many, many things I do, including the Village podcast from the bookshelf.
Right on, right on. I will be back here later today at 5 p.m. That's for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. And I am also on Twitter and the Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. And you can go to my local politics page, Guelph Politico, at guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. I hope to shorten that URL in the very near future. Anyway, I'll have more details on that later. You can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next week. I am not sure what day and time yet, because as I explained at the beginning of the show, this is somebody else's slot we've been filling through the summer. But check our Facebook and Twitter for when you'll be able to hear us next. And until next time, what did Siskel and Ebert used to say at the end of the show? He was like, we'll save you a seat or something. I don't know.
See you at the theater, or see you in the aisle, or something.
Maybe.
Something about
we'll
the aisle.
We'll have to come up with a cool way to end the show, so we'll just say the end.